Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Good morning, Kieran. Sorry, that was a sad, melancholy clearing of the throat there. Kieran shouldn't have done that on air, but don't really care this morning. producer guy doesn't like us talking about football, which is for the best, really. Otherwise, we'd be here for 2 hours talking about Jordan Henderson being a metaphor for everything that's wrong with English football. But I've got a cat to share that with, Kieran, although she's gone under the bed because she's had 2 hours of it already this morning. How are you? Did you watch the game? Did you enjoy, the game?
Yeah, I did. I popped down to the local store beforehand, and the guy behind the counter, he says, you that guy from that podcast? I go, what do you mean that podcast? He said, the football. Yeah. He says, you're the fourth most famous person in the village. And I thought, wow. Christ, the football has made me.
Wow. Well, we know. Let's see if we can work out who the. I know the Crankies live in the village, don't they? So do they?
No. He then told me that the three most famous people in our village is Tom Baker, ex Doctor Who, Jane Torville, and Rag and Bone Man, who I believe is some sort of pop beat combo type of person for young people.
Wow. I've never. I'd love to meet Rag and Bone Man because I'm a big fan. The first two you named, I've met, and I'd be happy not to do so again. in their own way, quite interesting people to work with for some time. But that's for a different pod, Kieran, entitled The Price of Jordan Henderson and Jane Torville. Jane Torville's dancing partner, on the other hand, all right, which is, for me, very high praise. It's questions day, Kieran. First question, it says here, is why Jordan Henderson... Never mind. We do have a little bit of news, Kieran, which we will discuss in more detail on Thursday. But this is good news for those who have gone early on independent regulator in Price of Football Bingo.
Because, yes, absolutely.
two of the grown-up newspapers are reporting this morning that the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has agreed that an independent regulator for football will be appointed and will possibly be named next week. So we'll get more details on that, Kieran. We'll do a bit more research. And hopefully we can tap into some of your contacts at the highest levels of government and talk to somebody who might know a thing or two about who the independent regulator will be.
Well, we'll say, and I'm not talking the man down the shop. We'll ask some people to come on. If this is going to go ahead and it is good news, I have been lucky enough to go to DCMS on a few occasions this year and meet some of the people there. And there's some really very thorough, very progressive people who are involved in the project, and I know it's a bit of a it's a bit of a cliche that I mention it all the time, but for those people as well as for us as fans, I think it will be a huge step forward in terms of football. We did go through a period of, I think it was 44 days of not having much chance of a regulator. That may have coincided with one of the prime ministers being in office for that period of time. But I think this is positive news.
Yeah, I think we can dispense with the May have coincided there. It coincided with arguably the worst 44 days of leadership this country's ever seen. It's a great shame, Kieran, that the late, lovely and very much lamented Kirsty MacColl didn't do a song called "The Guy Down the Shop Says I'm the Fourth Most Famous Person in the Village."
But yes.
I'd be quite happy. If you want to get him on, I'd be quite happy. Our first question comes from Jeff Cross, who I believe was known as Jeff Optimistic until he saw the team sheet. It's before the team. Jeff says, I'd be really interested. Apologies to all our listeners, of course, who aren't England fans all over the world, who are still chuckling and looking for the ball that Harry Kane chipped over the crossbar with that penalty. Jeff Cross says, I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on the investment bonds that a number of clubs, Peterborough United, for example, are offering.
Yes, I think this is an interesting way in terms of where clubs are looking for in terms of funding. Clearly, we have owner funding, which has been the case at Peterborough United. If you are following activities at that club, you will see that there seems to be. I think there's one or two issues. The main man there, Dara McAntony, is quite combative, shall we say, on social media, and he's got his own podcast and so on. And I've always gone fine, but I think there's a limit to what owners are willing to put in, and the idea of an investment bond, we call it an investment bond, it's actually a loan. You know, so let's get the terminology right. So we've seen them at Wimbledon, QPR, Peterborough, Norwich, and quite often they are for specific projects. So I think the one at Norwich was for sort of, you know, the training facilities, and you put money in and you get sort of two or three things back. First of all, potentially you're going to get an interest payment. I think with the one at Wimbledon, they offered, you know, if you want to put money in and get nothing back financially apart from your money back at a later date in time, that you can charge 0% interest. I think they had tiered rates of interest. The one at Peterborough is interesting in the sense that it's paying 9% interest. That's pretty sizable. And then you get a 15% bonus if the club is promoted to the Championship. So those are, you know, those are pretty steep rates of interest. But it would be cheaper potentially than borrowing from a bank. And also, I'll be honest, if I was a bank manager, and don't take this wrong, people in Peterborough, I wouldn't lend you because I think I just perceive you to be too risk. So you might say, well, 9%, yeah, that's fantastic. You can compare that to what you get in an ISA and so on. Also, you get an emotional return. And for the sake of complete transparency, I have bought one of the Peterborough bonds myself, as I've also bought one for Wimbledon and one other club, which I'm not going to mention here, just because I believe in football. And it's, from my point of view, it's a good return. On top of that, you might get some club-related benefits. So, you know, you might get a special badge, or you might get an invite to a match, or something like this. So there are other benefits as well. The downside, and here, you know, I'm not a financial advisor, but I can add up just about. the money that you're putting in is effectively an unsecured loan. So if things go wrong at the club and it goes bust, potentially you're going to lose up to all of your money. So it's not like putting money into an ISA, into a regulated fund, where you do have some protection from the Bank of England. So bear that in mind. If you are a fan of the club and you've got a little bit of extra, or if you're a football fan and you've got a little bit of extra and you want to buy into these things, that's fine. But you're also effectively buying into the current management or the current ownership structure. What happens if those owners leave and a new bunch of owners come in and, for want of a better phrase, they turn out to be wrong-uns? So you know, I might make an investment decision based on my personal perception of the people in charge of Club X or Club Y. If that club is then sold to, you know, let's say we make up a name. Let's say somebody called Borance Lassini or something like that. You might then start to get twitchy. And because these bonds tend to be for a fixed period of time, you know, normally it'll be for 3 years or 5 years. In 5 years' time, you're going to get your money back and you'll have picked up the interest on the way. If that new owner has come in and has run the club into the ground, then you might not get your money. So it's a risk. I would never encourage anybody to put any money into any form of investment unless their finances dictate that it is effectively it's your discretionary excess money that you feel that you've got some savings, you want to diversify your portfolio of where you put it and so on. I'd never put 100% into anything, but I would say as a note of caution, they do have benefits in terms of potential high returns. The downside, unsecured, and you're effectively backing the current managers or management team. If they change, things could change. And because normally, when ownership of a big club takes place, so if Manchester United or Liverpool are sold over the course of the next few months, all of those banks that have lent money to Manchester United, and we're talking about very senior banks, they have something called a change of control clause, which means that if the club is sold, the bank has the right to demand its money back immediately because it might not like the new owners. Whereas I don't have that in respect of the bonds that I've bought.
I like the sound of this guy, Borance Lassini. Can we get him on the pod? Yes. I'm going to take a leaf out of your book and refer from now on to Horden Jenderson, but you'll know who I'm talking about. I was going to write my Christmas cards today, Kieran, but I think I'll leave it because people will be going, why has he written Merry Henderson, Love from the Hendersons? He seems to be obsessed. I'm intrigued by what you say there, Kieran, especially by the fact you wouldn't mention the third club after Wimbledon and Peterborough. But I always assumed that when clubs did investment bonds, that they were administered by an independent financial agency. So is there, extending your example, say Palace were to do one and I was to to lend them some money. It's an unlikely scenario. The scenario of me lending them money is a very unlikely one. But, and then say Steve Parish and the Americans sold to a syndicate. Could that syndicate legally turn around and say, well, you didn't lend us the money. You lent the previous owners the money, so we don't see that we as a club have any legal right to pay you back.
Right. I mean, in terms of the administration of these, there are organisations such as Tifosi that tend to do the marketing, tend to do all of the administration, because football clubs are not set up. Yeah, they don't have the experience of doing this, so therefore you do find a third party to do this on your behalf. And if that is the case, then there is some sort of an extra layer of professionalism that goes into the arrangement, which does, I think, give you a little bit of comfort, but there's no financial comfort if things go wrong. In terms of a takeover of the club, ultimately, I am lending the money to Peterborough United Football Club or AFC Wimbledon Football Club. And not the shareholders of that club. So that we have to have a separation from organisation and owners. So if new people come into the club, they can't suddenly turn around. I mean, they can try to negotiate some sort of deal. They might, if somebody took over from Peterborough, they might say, well, 9% is a lot of money. We can't afford to do that. And they'll write to you and say, can we come to some sort of arrangement? Can we give you money back now? And that way we don't have to go and pay you 9% for the next 3 years or however long it's going to be.
Do you think it could possibly deter some bidders for a club, Kieran? If Peterborough United, for example, owed, I'm not entirely sure the amounts involved, but say they owed £500,000 and were due to pay back £545,000.
Yeah.
Is that something, did I get that right? Yes. Then, a potential bidder might think, well, that's an extra level of cost that we can't afford if we buy this club for £5 million, £6 million.
Yeah, yes, because whenever you do an assessment of any business takeover, the price that you're prepared to pay is linked to future expected cash flows. And that's going to be cash flows in and out. So in the case of Peterborough, if they sold £500,000 worth of these bonds, so as you rightly said, that's an extra £45,000 financial commitment for the next X years going out of the club. It's a bit like if you buy a house and all of a sudden you find, there's an additional ground rent on the property because of some old covenant or something, then that might impact upon how much you're prepared to pay for the house. Because when you're looking at the house, you say, right, I've got my expected mortgage payments, I've got my heating and lighting payments, which you get going through the roof, and I've got rates, and then there's this additional one because it's in a private road and you've got to go and pay a management fee. I hadn't factored that in. That might therefore mean that you're not prepared to pay as much for the house because the cash outflows all of a sudden have become heavier.
I've actually written down "well done!" exclamation mark on my notes for getting a very basic mathematical sum correct.
Which, I don't think it's that basic. He did it instantly.
Yeah, well, it's considering the hangover I've got is remarkable. Alex Hall has our next question. It's a very interesting one. It's not quite up there with which player's worth their weight in gold. or indeed with our last question today, which is very close to worth their weight in gold. I didn't think we'd get two questions that I liked so much in 2 weeks. But Alex Hall is it's a very interesting question, Kieran, and it's one of those, again, that I'm surprised hasn't been mentioned before. Alex says that Kieran has mentioned often that if a relegated Premier League club is promoted straight back up, then the parachute payments they would have received had they remained in the Championship are split between the Premier League clubs. Therefore, it would seem to be in the interest of the Premier League clubs for relegated clubs to come straight back up. And would this then mean that they're more likely to loan out decent players to those clubs who are in the Championship to get them promoted rather than their non-parachute receiving rivals? That's, it's crafty, Kieran, but is it possible? It makes perfect sense.
Well, Mr. Machiavelli is doffing his cap as we speak, I think. I think he's just Alex has been plotting away here, and this is fantastic. Let's take a look at the numbers. If you are a club in receipt of parachute payments, the amounts you receive are broadly going to be £41 million in the first season, £34 in the second, and £16 in the third. So therefore, if you come back after one season, the Premier League effectively saves itself 34 plus 16. So it saves itself £50 million. It keeps an additional £50 million. If you do that for three clubs, you've got an additional £150 million coming into the Premier League, which works out as around about £7.5 million a club.
I'm writing "well done" down again, Kim, but it's for you this time.
So for a club, for a club like ours, where the average wages is 50 odd grand a week, that's paying for three players' wages for a season. So that could be an issue. I mean, I think there are caps on the number of players that you're allowed to loan, but if I was a Premier League club and I had a choice of two, and I was from the Dick Dastardly school of sneakiness, it's worth taking into consideration. Is one player going to make that much of a difference? It's questionable. And also, if I was that Premier League club, my biggest concern would be in respect of player development, because let's take my club, Brighton. A few years ago, we had Ben White on our books, and he went on loan to a League Two club, on loan to a League One club, and then we were looking for a loan to a Championship club. And I know the club went through an awful lot of offers. He was a promising player at the time, the decision was made to let him go to Leeds because they felt that under Bielsa that would help his development. And according to Leeds fans, the reason that he became a £50 million player was due to his year in the Championship there. So therefore, you see that we benefited financially because he came back as a better player. And, you know, you could argue he would have done the same. Use that good a player, he'd have done it anywhere else. But in terms of the individual player development, if you can then sell that player because they have impressed in the Championship, you want them to go to the right club for that player. And one of the biggest errors that I think people make when lending out players, or when loaning out players, should I say, is that they just take the highest fee rather than look at, you know, the management style, the cultural style of that club. Is that a good fit in terms of you're looking for that player to come back to you in 12 months' time and not have to have a significant readjustment upon return?
Which is why I think most Premier League clubs now, we have Mark Bright doing it, for example, have somebody whose full-time job is managing loans in and out, basically.
Yeah.
Deciding the right fit and also looking after their welfare when they're with other clubs or other players that are with us. I was going to suggest, Kieran, to avoid annoying him, that you swap the initials of Dick Dastardly around, but I realised the flaw in that argument halfway through. Plus, he's fictional, so... Stuart, well, he's tiny if he's not. Stuart White, as another playoff based question, and it's an interesting one. Stuart White says, my team, Huddersfield Town, reached the final of the Championship playoffs last season. And it got me wondering about the financial impact of those extra three games. Do the home clubs in the semi finals keep the gate money, or is it shared? What share of the proceeds do the finalists receive? Assuming that Fulham and Bournemouth will have received prize money for automatic promotion, will the playoff winners generate so much more profit via the extra three games that they will make more money than the two automatically promoted teams? You know what I find interesting about that question, Kieran, is that we still talk about gate money, even in 2020. It's like that, as you've always talked about, the fact we talk about players' wages. It's another of those phrases that indicate the working class roots of the game, isn't it?
It is. It is. You're absolutely right. And just another quick plug for the film Gate Money, about what happened when the National Lottery Fund gave the National League £10 million and how that money was carved up. If the independent regulator is now going to be bottomed off, if the people at DCMS would like to perhaps demand a copy of the Bernstein report, which was commissioned by the National League and has never been published, into how that money was distributed, I think that could be beneficial for all. There's still an awful lot of people in what we refer to as non-league football, effectively the National League, who are very, very unhappy. And anybody that listened to Mark White in our bonus episode on Friday will realise that he's one of those. He said, even though our club actually benefited from it, it was so wrong. But back to...
Can I just stop you there, Kieran? The fact that you used the phrase carved up indicates to me that you are less than happy about the distribution of that money. It's a very emotive term, isn't it?
Yes.
Uncle Terry used to carve things up, but in a slightly different way. But it's... anyway, Stuart White, there's a lot of Mr. White's today, but Stuart White's question, which again is, as I say, is a good one.
Yes, let's just unpack. I think it's got a few questions here. In respect of the semi-finals, effectively, of the playoff games, the money goes to the home club. The home club is hosting the match in exactly the same way as if you have a cup match. So the home clubs do their work. The away club will clearly, you know, normally will sell tickets, but those tickets are being sold on behalf of the home club, and the away club, you know, you normally get a commission for each ticket you sell. So that's what happens as far as the semi-finals are concerned. Now, when it gets to the finals, in theory, the money is going to be split evenly. But this is one of the reasons, despite all of the, all of the many things that are wrong in the game, I don't know who first introduced this, but we sort of have what you might call an old school gentleman's agreement that the winning team in the playoff final is about to receive £100 million for getting promoted to the Premier League. So this is very much for the Championship, to the Premier League one. The losing team, as well as the sort of the emotional turmoil of losing the match, is going to have another season of £7 million a year in the Championship. So what quite a few clubs do is the chief executives will phone each other up before the match and say, look, let's do this. The loser keeps all of the gate receipts, or keeps all of, or effectively keeps both clubs share the gate receipts. It's very much sort of a Jim Bowen, look what you could have won, consolation prize. But if you've got 80,000 people turning up to the match, you are getting effectively 40,000 receipts, 40,000 sets of receipts that you wouldn't have otherwise got. So that's what actually is the case. Now, when it comes to the club that is promoted, they don't get anything extra for winning the EFL Championship or League One or League Two. There's no prize money as such. The money is actually split very evenly. And I know one of the potential changes that might go through following the ding dong that's going on between the Premier League and the EFL, and the Premier League's not coming out of this particularly well, is that one of the things that has been suggested is that money will be allocated according to your position in the table in EFL leagues, just as it is as far as the Premier League is concerned. But in the Premier League, it's worth an extra 2.5 million pounds per place. That money would have a significant lack of zeros on it in EFL. But I know it's something which is being discussed. But if you win, Fulham and Bournemouth would not have got any extra money for automatic promotion. So therefore, the playoff winners, in theory, will be better off financially. So you might say, well, is it therefore better to go up via the playoffs? And to which my response would be no, because if you are promoted, you've normally got a minimum of 3 weeks earlier in which to plan your next season in the Premier League. And that means that you can start to get involved in booking those upgrades for the floodlights, for giving the recruitment team the feelers that they've put out. Because I think we had somebody from Norwich on the show a while ago, and they said they effectively have two budgets. In the Premier League, a survival budget and a relegation budget, and in the Championship, what happens if we go up and what happens if we don't go up? And then you can start to implement those budgets that much earlier. So you've probably got a list of 12 players, six of whom we're going to recruit if we don't go up, six of whom we're going to target if we do go up, and you can start to put wheels into motion. And I think people perhaps are unfamiliar with the way that the system works in terms of player recruitment. We see a deal going through in June, July, August, but quite often the first contact will have been made a few months earlier, and therefore at the end of the season you're starting to get the vibes as to whether or not that player's interested and whether or not that club's interested. So you are better off financially to go through the playoffs in the sense of additional prize money, but in terms of preparation, you are far better off going through automatic promotion.
Yeah, I would say going up via the playoffs is much better, but only if you're 100% guaranteed to go up.
Yes.
If you knew beforehand that you were definitely going to win the final at Wembley, that's better. Otherwise, let's try and finish first and second, boys. And for those of our younger listeners, or the listeners around the world who didn't get the reference, Jim Bowen used to host a remarkably low rent but very entertaining quiz based on the game of darts. Called Bullseye, and Jim Bowen, who's one of the nicest people I've ever met, but also in a state of permanent bemusement, would often expect. My favourite ever episode of Bullseye was when Jim Bowen couldn't get his head round the fact that this chap lived on the 14th floor of a tower block in Rotherham. It's like, because Jim Bowen said, I've been to Rotherham, I can't, there isn't a tower block. It's Jim, I live on the 14th floor of a tower block. And then he won a speedboat. Just basically, as the titles roll, you could see this bloke saying to Jim Bowen, what the fuck am I going to do with this speedboat? I imagine he would have sold it for quite some money. I don't know, but you can still see it on YouTube. It's still just as entertaining. But those were the days when you could walk off with a tankard with two £5 notes sticking out of it as your prize, plus a rubber ball. Joshua Masson isn't quite as Machiavellian
He's got bully special prize in this week's episode, though, for it.
He's not quite as Alex Hall Machiavellian, but there's an element of it in this question. And Joshua Massa says, often selling clubs will receive a bonus payment when a player they've sold plays a part in the buying club winning a trophy. For example, Aston Villa getting a bonus for Jack Grealish winning the league with Manchester City. Don't bonuses like this create a potential conflict of interest like the end of last season when City needed to beat Villa to win the title? Again, it's one of those questions that you think, oh, really? But then underneath it, there is a genuine question to be asked here, Kieran, isn't there?
Well, there is, because you could argue that that City winning that match was a win-win deal for both clubs,
yeah,
financially.
For both, you know,
City got the benefit of being the Premier League champions and the rewards that come with that, and Villa earned extra money. And if you go into the small print of Manchester City's accounts, and I've done this for you, Kevin.
Oh, yeah,
you're otherwise engaged. So I was looking at note 23 of the accounts this morning. And Manchester City potentially have to pay up to £197 million in add-on fees if they win certain trophies.
Wow.
Wow. And that would probably be, you know, City doing the quadruple and Jack Grealish winning the Ballon d'Or, you know, and lots of other players, lots of other things kicking in as well. But I think it does show the extent to which deals are incentivized, and that's to reward the club that was involved in the development of the player. There's nothing wrong with that. That's great, and also to reward the player for cheap achievements on a personal and a team level. But the numbers involved and the numbers for Manchester United are equally eye-watering. I think we'll probably be covering Manchester United's first quarterly accounts on Thursday's show. Mm. But then you start to say these numbers and you become inoculated to them. You know, it's as if £197 million, it doesn't sound like very much. And you go, hold on, you know, because you and I both can remember the first £100,000 player. Let alone the first, you know, Trevor Francis and the first £999,999 player and so on. But the numbers involved in football these days have increased at a rate which is, I think, is difficult to fathom from the beautiful game of the working man perspective.
And to save a producer guy and his extensive legal team having what my gran used to refer to as conniptions, never quite understood, and she always used it out of context either. It's like, no, it's a telephone, Gran. It's not a conniption. There's no inference at all. You know, I think the one thing we all believe in is the integrity of every game in the Premier League. I think every single team sets out to try and win every single game in the Premier League, and there's no hint that we are suggesting that Aston Villa didn't do anything otherwise than try and win.
They were 2-0 up with 12 minutes to go, weren't they?
Let's not pick at that, Scab. Also, I like your idea of referring to him as Jack Grealish, which I think Man City's lawyers could go, no, you, Jack Grealish gets a bonus, but we signed Jack Grealish. You should read the contract.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Our next question comes from an American listener called John Kellogg, which is a great name. I'd love to know, John, if you are related to the Kellogg family who came up with the cornflakes and that, because they were fascinating people. But John Kellogg's question is this. Recently, it was announced that the US women's national team will be paid the same as the men. However, I read that the women were in fact already making more money per player than the men because of their recently negotiated contract with the USSF. Despite the success of the women's team internationally, I'm hard-pressed to believe that they did in fact earn more than the men. Either way, though, I'm still very proud of my country for finally addressing the pay disparity.
Yes, this is an interesting one in the sense that there's two elements to players' earnings. First of all, there's match fees. And I think the Norway were the first country to have equalisation of match fees between the men's and the women's team. And that's been followed. I know England have done it, Ireland have done it, Brazil, Spain. And that's great. You know, and that's appropriate. You are representing your country.
Yeah.
So, you know, your gender isn't irrelevant. You are representing your country as an international football player. And therefore, I can see no reason why you should be paid more or less depending upon on gender. The second issue is one of prize money. So, you know, we've mentioned this before. England players give their match fees to charity. I think that's absolutely fantastic. I think Gary Neville was the first person to organise that. You know, hats off to Gary Neville. I know he upset some people, but you know, I think he does an awful lot of good on things like that in terms of, you know, social conscience. And it's the players aren't going to miss the match fee itself. Secondly, there are the players' pools and prize money. Now, what we have in the USA, which I don't think is the case for you know, for England, for example, is the prize money for both the US women's national team and the men's national team, that has been equalized as well. So if you get to the quarterfinals, the semifinals, if you win the competition, then those levels of money are set in stone. I don't think that is the case for the national teams of those other countries that we've mentioned. And if I'm wrong, you know, apologies, but I can't see any mention to this. I think the equalisation has been in respect of the match fees. Now, is it justified? Yeah, we can have a broad existential discussion on this. The argument goes that given that the prize money handed out by FIFA is so much greater for the men's game than the women's game, this allows the individual football associations to pay the men's team more, and because it's based on, you know, viewing figures and so on. So that's the argument that's put forward. Could the men's and women's team come together? Could the FA make a decision to say, well, we're effectively going to pool you know, the money from you know, the men's and the women's World Cup and come up with some form of equalisation for prize money? That's a decision for the FA to make up.
Well, considering that our women's team are capable of winning tournaments, Kieran, and it would be shameful if they weren't getting paid the same amount of money. But yes, that's another one for research. Put that on your list, Kieran.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Martin Jenkins asks a simple question, but it's one that could have big financial ramifications, actually. Do you think football could see advertising placed permanently on the pitch each season, like you see in UK ice hockey?
Possibly. We had Leicester's groundsman on, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago? I think he might have a word, to put it quite mildly. If you're going to invest all of that money on a playing surface which is geared towards maximising, we talk about football and professional sport these days all about being marginal gains. So if you're going to go to the trouble of having the nature of the woven pitch, the length of the grass, all of these other issues being organised in such a manner as to maximise your chances of winning the game, to have some bloke turn up with a bit of whitewash and to go and blogs the butcher in the middle of it, I think the groundsman would be very unhappy. But it's certainly something which club owners would be keener on until perhaps they got educated by the groundsman, and I know who my money's on when it comes to that argument. Martin, I think, does raise an interesting issue in that I often get asked, why is it that clubs in the NFL make so much more money from TV than football clubs. And the reason is advertising. So, you know, in an average NFL match, I think, you know, it lasts, what, 2.5 hours, would it, something like that. The ball, or, you know, there's only action for 11 minutes. Yeah, most of the time is people either standing still, timeouts, breaks. The game is geared toward, the game was designed for television, whereas football existed pre-television in a sense. And the way that NFL has evolved has been very much to assist the broadcasters in maximizing their revenue take. We have seen some suggestions. You know, was it Perez that suggested that football should be cut into four quarters because that would allow you know, more breaks equals more money? If you listen to some commercial radio stations, they're now advertising during the match, normally in conjunction with bookmakers. From the TV company's point of view, having to go, if you're a commercial TV company, having to go 45 minutes without an advert is just, yeah, it's a nightmare. So I think they will be trying to come up with ways of, even if you can't do it physically, so if you physically attend a match, you won't be able to see the logo, but could the Premier League sell some form of augmented reality in which, if you're watching the match on telly, all of a sudden, you know, the left-hand of the side of the pitch is sponsored by Sony and the right-hand side of the pitch is sponsored by Ford, and those logos come up on the pitch as if they were there in reality. Watch this space.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth, Kieran, because I was going to suggest, with digital technology being what it is, I think within the next decade we will see that sort of abhorrence. And in answer to your question, Julian, club owners don't tend to have pitchforks, so I know who I'd be backing in that argument. Plus, most of the club owners I've met don't have the same attitude that ground staff have either. So I don't think that fight would take long. Daniel Nethercote has a question that's got a lot of numbers in it, Kieran, so you'll like this. Daniel Nethercote's question says, with the new FFP rules set to come in featuring a soft wage cap of around 75% to 80% of revenue and some of the clown shoe clubs in the championship ratio running at over 100%, what would the effects be to them? What changes will be required? E.g., will they have to fall in line with the 75-80% cap? And what sort of timeline for adjusting to full compliance might there be?
Right. Well, if we take a look at the position that now exists with UEFA, UEFA are effectively introducing these rules, which are replacing financial fair play over a three-year period. And what's going to happen is that in year one, the amount of money that you spend on player and management wages and agent fees, and I think it's your net transfer expenditure, can be no more than 90% of revenue. That drops to 80% in the second year. And then going forward on a long-term basis, it's going to be 70%. And I look at this and, you know, I go back to my first ever law lecture at university, where this professor came in and he says, right, you all think law is clear cut. Just remember, for every rule, there's a loophole. And that has struck, that has stuck, should I say, and struck with me ever since. So these are UEFA's rules. Are there ways of circumventing the rules? Yes, there are. I'll say no more than that. It just needs somebody smart enough to come up with them. And it also protects the rich, because if you are Real Madrid and you've got revenue of £600 million, 70% of £600 million is £420. If you're a club that's just got into the Champions League for the first time, if we look at Rangers and Celtic, they've got revenue of around about £100 million. Well, 70% of that is £70 million. Can you see it allows the bigger clubs to pay the bigger wages, to reinforce the gap that already exists within football. And it's, in my view, it's anti-competitive, which is perhaps that's what the people want. In terms of the EFL, what would happen here is that we would need to have a vote by club owners. And historically, club owners in the Championship have rejected wage caps. If we go back, was it last year or the year before, when the clubs in League One and League Two, they unilaterally introduced a wage cap along these lines. Well, no, so it was a hard wage cap of 2.5 million and 1.5 million in Leagues 1 and League 2, respectively. And the EFL asked the clubs in the Championship, do you want to introduce something? And they said, we're not even bothering to put it to a vote. There was so much opposition. So the only way that these rules could be introduced is A, the clubs vote for them, or B, there is an independent regulator appointed who has executive power, in which they can set some form of wage cap or wage control. And we'll have to wait to see. And in terms of what happened in Leagues 1 and League 2, our very good friend Nick DeMarco was appointed by the PFA to act on their behalf, because the rules, the original rules, were that there had to be a negotiation between the players and clubs, and these rules were imposed. And Nick DeMarco got that particular wage cap issue very quickly rescinded.
Yeah, well, hopefully, as we said at the start of the show, we'll be discussing more about the independent regulator on Thursday's show. And again, I think the most interesting thing we're waiting to see, Kieran, is whether or not they do have executive powers, as you suggest, because without those, there's pretty much no point having one. Our penultimate question comes from Adam Cowley, and it's quite a plaintive one, this, Kieran. I'm almost sad to read it out. But Adam says, I'm a Swindon Town fan, still coming to terms with the penalty shootout loss at Port Vale and at least another year in League Two. I watched that game and I share your pain, brother. This season, all of the other West Country teams have been promoted, so now the closest clubs to us are Northampton and Wimbledon. Last season, we had the likes of Exeter and Bristol Rovers bringing 1,000-plus fans, but generally, away teams only sell about 200 to 400 tickets. I can't see that improving next season. How will this affect the budgeting for that season?
Negatively is the simple way of putting it. In terms of lower gate receipts, I work out it's potentially could be costing Swindon around about £15,000 per match. Now, that's going to, if you've got three or four matches on a similar nature, then we're talking 50 grand. I think, again, we become so inoculated to numbers in football because at the top end they are so high. £50,000 is a significant amount of money for a club like Swindon Town.
Of course.
What I would say is that under the new owner, Clep Clem, the club's finances do seem far better organised. I think they will make up for that over the course of the season, because Swindon Town is no longer a toxic name locally, and therefore, whilst times are tough in terms of signing commercial and sponsorship deals, the club's in a far better position than it was when it was appearing on this show too often. In the non-question show, it was appearing too often on Thursdays, I think I'm delighted for people there, because we got to know some of the people there, that things are moving forwards.
I suppose as well, Kieran, the other theory is that for each season you have in League Two, you probably leech another 100, 200 of your own home fans as well, don't you, really? And the converse of that, of course, is that promotion to League One would probably add 500 to your attendance, I would guess.
Yes, look at who's in League One. Derby, Ipswich, Charlton, Sheffield Wednesday. It's got what I call proper decent sized clubs who've spent some time in the Premier League themselves. Pompey are there as well. So away fans tend to turn in numbers. So that 1,000-plus would be considerably higher, especially if a club like Derby comes to town, and Derby are having a going through a pretty positive phase at present on the pitch, which is really good under Paul Warne. Then they will sell out every single ticket, and it will be the same with Sheffield Wednesday and so on.
Our final question, Kieran, and I think we've both been looking forward to this.
Yes,
and it comes from Matthew Wilcox. Hello, Matthew. Matthew Wilcox says, being a fellow accountant, I have a love for graphs and data that exceeds the limits of normal people. I know a couple of people, Matthew, that would might take that as a challenge. One of my favourites is funny correlations. For instance, the divorce rate in Maine correlates with the consumption of margarine. As margarine consumption has declined, so too has the divorce rate. And my question is, has Kieran noticed any mad correlations while trawling through his massive spreadsheets? Are clubs with red kits more likely to go into administration, for example? I just love the fact that I imagine Matthew was chuckling to himself as he wrote this question, as he thought of more funny correlations. And then he called in Mrs. Wilcox and said, here's another one. And Mrs. Wilcox, I'm busy, and did exactly that. That was the sound effect.
That was Finlay exiting the room as this question was asked.
because the correlation between questions and Wonky Chomp donations has gone down terribly. But I just love this question, Kieran, and I understand where Matthew's coming from. So have you noticed any bizarre correlations?
I suspect that Matthew and I don't get asked to the same parties.
Or rather, you should get asked the same parties, because then you could put you two in a corner and nobody else will have to entertain them.
I think this is an interesting one. For those people that like stats and numbers, this is the issue of correlation versus causality. There are some numbers.
That old chestnut.
That was one of my opening lines when I used to strut my funky stuff down the pink coconut. Always went home alone. So correlation is where you've got two numbers moving in the same direction at roughly the same rate. So there appears to be some link between the question. And lots of people confuse correlation with causality. They say, well, if two numbers are moving in that same direction at the same rate, then surely one of those numbers must be dragging the other number up or down. So if I give you another example, if we take a look at the level of deaths caused by being eaten by a shark and ice cream sales, they have a very strong correlation. Ooh. So you then say to yourself, well, could we therefore get rid of people being eaten alive by sharks or attacked by sharks? I was being a bit melodramatic there. But could we reduce the number of shark attacks by reducing the level of ice cream sales? If you banned ice cream sales in every seaside town, would it mean that shark deaths go away? And you go, well, that's ludicrous. See, there's clearly nothing in connection. And what tends to be is that there is a there are other factors which you're ignoring. So when do most shark deaths take place? They take place in the summer, where the water is warmer, and therefore the sharks are more likely to come up closer to shore. When do most ice cream sales take place? They take place in the summer because the weather is warmer, and we have ice creams because we have ice creams to cool ourselves down. So I've looked at my numbers, and I'm going to look harder, Matthew, just for you. But as yet, I've not found anything which could even tickle my funny bone in relation to this vast legion of spreadsheets. But if you want to drop me a line, Matthew, I'll tell you what, I'll send you my master football spreadsheet, which has got 150 different tabs on, and they are all color-coordinated to the club shirt. And people say, well, how can you do that? You're colorblind. It's because I can read the labels on the colors. I don't know what the colors are, but so if you want that, just drop me a line, Matthew, and perhaps you can take a look, and perhaps we can have some private correspondence on this.
Wow, I'm welling up here, Kieran. Matthew, that's the ultimate. Kieran's never offered me, obviously. I wouldn't know what to do with it, but not many people get offered the master spreadsheet, Matthew. That's wow. Also, Kieran, I'm on about to say here that you're dismissing this causality between the shark and the ice cream thing without any basic research. You know, there's lots of fancy flavours of ice cream now. How do we know that pistachio isn't like catnip to sharks?
Ah.
How do we know that suddenly, after all these years, the sharks are sitting there going, that's an interesting smell, I'm going to move in close? We don't know, Kieran, so you can't just dismiss it like that. I know a very funny joke about somebody being eaten by a shark, but it's got too many rude words to share with you now, unfortunately. But Matthew Wilcox, in the spirit of generosity that we're heading towards Christmas, if you want to email me, I'll share the joke with you. Thank you for listening today. The first ever Price of Football replica shirt is now available to pre-order. And if you're lucky, there'll be a very funny video teasing it coming your way shortly. If my son ever gets to fulfill his promise of editing it together for us, he's too busy basking in his ITV advert. They're available in adults and kids sizes, and all the profits will go to a charity called Gambling With Lives, which is a very good cause. Find the link to our online shop by going to priceoffootball.com or our social media pages or the description of this episode in your podcast app. You'll notice I haven't made any jokey reference to our online shop, Kieran. That's because I got one of producer guys' sniffy emails pointing out that we do in fact have an online shop. And could I stop suggesting that we don't have I didn't know we had an online shop, Kieran. That's all I'm saying. But we have an online shop.
The Price of Football t-shirts can be bought there. Perhaps we ought to bring back the mugs.
There's too many potential punchlines for that, Kieran. I can't. yes, indeed. So go to that online shop by going to priceoffootball.com or our social media pages or the description of this episode in your podcast app. Thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, thank you very much. You can do so by going to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. In the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran McGuire for his customary farewell.
Well, as always, thanks to those very kind people at Patreon that do give us support for the show. But there's other ways you can show your groovy vibes towards the Price of Football podcast, and that's to go onto your podcast app and to give us a review. If you could give us 5 stars, we've been over 2,100 reviews when I last took a look, which is very kind of you. Give us 5 stars. It helps us in the charts. It helps us with algorithms. If you want to write a review, I always read them. Quite often. They're far more entertaining than any of the crap that I put out. It doesn't actually matter what you would say. You could even say you would rather have the show presented by Rag and Bone Man and Tom Baker. And if we can't afford Tom Baker, I'm sure John Colchuth will do it for half the price. And it wouldn't make a blind bit of difference to us in the charts.
We can afford Tom Baker. It's Rag and Bone Man we can't afford. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.